This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, what kind of farm would you want in your community? Small dairy farm owned by someone you know, or a big 500-head dairy farm run by someone you've never met who might not even live in your community? If your answer was the small farm, you're not alone. For years, people have pointed to the trend of farms getting bigger as a problem, with some researchers arguing that big corporate farms are bad for rural communities. But our next guest says it's actually more complicated than that. He's the co-author of new research looking at the impact of farm consolidation on community well-being. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is it hard for small family farms to operate in your community? Have you seen them getting bigger and bigger where you live? If you are a farmer yourself, do you have a small operation, maybe what they call a hobby farm or boutique sort of operation, or have you gotten bigger or have you left the field? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Steve Deller is regional economist at the UW-Madison. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Oh, good afternoon. How are you doing today?
Good. Well, before we get into the study itself, Steve, the origins of it, it's kind of interesting. This started as an undergraduate student project?
Yes, it did. The economics department, the undergraduate student club, actually tries to hook up with faculty or researchers across campus to try to get a little bit of exposure, to have the students kind of exposed to, you know, what's it like to actually do a research project. And Iris Parks and I kind of hooked up on this question, and next thing you know, we ended up with a pretty good study.
Now let's get into farm consolidation. First of all, what do we see when it comes to the size of farms in Wisconsin and how that's changed over the years?
What's really happened is that when you look at the size of farms, much of the consolidation that was occurring kind of occurred in the 50s, the 60s, and the 70s, and then it kind of plateaued. So a lot of the consolidation that we're seeing now is kind of small compared to what was going on back in the 60s and the 70s. So what we're seeing now really is not so much that the average size farm is getting bigger. Indeed, it's not. It's kind of for the last 30 years almost, the average size farm has basically stayed the same. What's happened is the distribution around that average size farm. We're seeing kind of a hollowing out, if you will, of the middle of that distribution. If you think of it kind of like a bell-shaped curve, right, where the average farm is kind of in the middle there, what's happening is that middle is getting smaller and smaller and smaller. There's fewer people in that middle. What's happening is we're seeing growth at the what's called the two tails. The bigger farms, right, we're seeing some growth in the bigger farms, but we're seeing much more growth in the smaller farms. And that's where this kind of, you know, it's more complicated than simply farms getting bigger. We're seeing growth in small farms.
Now, part of what you're looking into here is what does it mean in a community if you lose those mid-sized farms and you only have the really big one that's maybe, you know, the owner and a bunch of hands, but not, I guess, owner-occupied farms all over the place and these tiny ones. First of all, how do you even start to try to answer a question like that? What does it mean for community well-being?
How do you define community well-being? If you look at kind of like economic growth, the relationship between farming and economic growth has gotten weaker and weaker and weaker over time. It's because so much of the rural economy has kind of grown beyond farming. Farming has stayed basically the same size. It's gotten a little bit bigger, but the rest of the economy has gotten bigger, particularly in Wisconsin. Now, if you're talking about the Corn Belt, say Iowa, then, you know, things could be a little bit differently. But the relationship between farming and the community is really kind of, it's changed. If you're looking at the large farms, the real impact of the large farms on the local community is through the wages that are paid. Particularly for dairy, it's the hired help spending their money in the local economy. That's where a lot of the economic impact is coming in. The other is kind of feeding into the food processing. In Wisconsin, food processing is extremely important. But what's happening at the other end is that we're seeing this growth in kind of, you think about the local foods movement, kind of this niche agriculture, if you will, or these specialty crops, if you will, there's real growth in that end. Those farms tend to be much, much smaller. So you have this kind of that typical average size farm doesn't really exist anymore. They're either smaller, specialized, or they're really big. Now, what's really kind of turned the relationship around between the farming and community is that for years and years and years, we used to think that rural communities depended upon farming. That relationship has really changed. Increasingly, all but the biggest farms, the farm household, the farm family, the vast majority of their income comes from off-farm sources. So it's not so much the farm contributing to the local economy. It is, but not that much. It's more that ability to generate off-farm income to keep the farm going. So that relationship has really kind of changed, but for the smaller size farms. For the bigger farms, they're still, you know, they may have off-farm income for primarily something like, say, health insurance. But the relationship between the big farms and the local community is still kind of that direction, but through the labor component.
Talking to Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, looking at changes in the scale of farming lots, as we're hearing, of smaller farms, a trend toward much, much larger, more consolidated farms, hollowing out the middle. What does it mean for rural communities? You could join in maybe with your experience in your community on your own farm at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Okay, Steve, let's take that case and look at your research here. You've got a community. It used to have a bunch of those mid-sized farms. They're not there anymore. Most of them are gone. And they've been replaced by maybe one or two or three operations of these larger scale farms. As you tapped into these measures of well-being, what kind of changes did you see, for better, worse, or neither?
Well, it depends on how you measure it. I mean, one of the things that we wanted to do when we talked about community well-being is that we looked at things like economic well-being, poverty, business startup rates, income levels. We also looked at things like public health and a wide range of kind of metrics. Well, it depends on how you define community well-being. Business startups, for example, having more farms, you actually see more business startups. That's one indicator. But in terms of health, you kind of have running a farm can be a very stressful thing. So it depends. It depends. And that's why one of the things with this whole kind of literature is trying to better understand the relationship between farming and community well-being is that we can't nail it down. We can't get a definitive answer. And the reason is because agriculture keeps changing. There's a big difference between a corn and soybean farmer that has 5,000 acres in central Illinois compared to a smaller farm, say in the Driftless area, that is trying to go into the local foods market. They're apples and oranges. And trying to draw a definitive generalization becomes very, very difficult.
But what things stood out to you in that consolidation scenario I just laid out? It's bigger farms. Were there that changes that struck you in terms of local economies, those local measures of well-being?
The bigger the farm, it really boils down to how profitable is that farm and how well can it pay the farmer and the workers. The bigger the farms, they tend to be able to afford to pay better wages. Those better wages have a positive impact on the local economy. So if you have a choice between 10 farms that are operating at poverty levels or two big farms that are actually paying halfway decent wages, you're better off with the two bigger farms because of the income that's going to the people that are working the farm. Now, when you're looking at a corn and soybean operation, though, you're not hiring that many workers. If you're talking about a dairy operation, you're talking about a lot of workers. So, again, it depends on what kind of process you're looking at.
We're talking to Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about the effect of farm consolidation on rural communities. Lots of variables there, as we're hearing. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen farming change in your community, in your part of the state? If you're a farmer yourself, what has changed for you? What kind of farming do you do? Have you gotten bigger in your operation, hiring more people? Have you gotten smaller and more specialized? If you live in a community that depends a lot on farming for the local economy, how have these things shaken out for you? And would you rather have a smaller farm, say dairy farm as your neighbor, versus a much larger one? Why would you go one way or the other? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our talk about the impact of farm consolidation on rural communities. Steve Deller with UW-Madison stays with us, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think bigger is better when it comes to farming, or do you want to see lots of smaller operations? What has changed when it comes to agriculture, to the farm sizes and operations in your own community? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go to your calls now. Roger is with us in Cottage Grove. Roger, hi.
Hi. I haven't heard Steve Deller talk about one of the really important measures of well-being, and that is the environment, how large farms affect the water quality, both surface and groundwater quality, and the air quality in rural communities. That's just a really, really important consideration in terms of a measure of well-being. And haven't heard any discussion about that. Would like to hear him comment on that.
Roger, thanks a lot for the call. And this is a big concern when people are worried about, especially larger livestock operations, Steve. I'm not sure if this current research went into that, but do you have some thoughts for Roger?
That's actually an excellent question. And our ability to kind of do these analyses, we're now able to actually start to talk about environmental impacts. We had kind of a, you know, dreamt about doing it 10 years ago, but now the science has advanced and we can actually start doing it. So, Roger, I hope to have some specific answers for you maybe by summertime. But you have, there's two things with farming. One is that many farmers are really very pro-environmental because they're kind of, they have this connection to the land that is very unique. So the vast majority of farmers are actually very sensitive to sustainable practices and not, being a poor steward of the land. The problem, though, is that you'll have one or two that are sloppy and you can actually have a fair amount of damage. You hear about perhaps a manure pit, a dairy manure pit that springs a leak and there's a massive fish kill off. So we tend to see things like that, but I think the vast majority of farmers are actually pretty sensitive and really want to try to do the right thing when it comes to the environment. But look around summertime. I hope to have a better answer than that for you.
Roger, thanks for calling in. We'll go to Jim now in Wattiewaukee. Jim, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. I am a retired farmer, and as I told your screener, between my farm and the closest town is 5 miles, and years ago there were 12 farms there milking cows, and now there's one, and he uses robotic milkers. So big change in the landscape, big change in the tax base because of all the farm buildings and houses that are gone, school districts that don't have the kids that they used to, small town businesses that don't have the local base of support that they used to. And I think it all comes down to price, that farms went out because they weren't paid a good enough price. And once we lost the parity programs of the New Deal and the consolidation took over, that changed everything.
Jim, thank you so much for sharing your story. Steve, your thoughts?
You're right. I mean, there are, as I mentioned before, there's this notion of get bigger, get out, and that's not true. There are some farmers that decide that maybe getting bigger is right for them, and they make that decision, good for them. There are others that say, you know, we can't maintain it the way it is. What we're going to do is we're going to downsize. We're going to get a little bit smaller. We're going to go to, say, grazing, or we'll go to specialty crops or something like that, but we need that off-farm income. we need somebody working off the farm to bring money into the farm family. And we're seeing a tremendous growth in that kind of a market. So the relationship between the community and the farm has kind of been turned on its head a little bit. Now, farmers that are able to get that off-farm income, or a spouse or someone in the family get that off-farm income, that can help keep that farm alive. If there is no off-farm employment opportunities, then you're right. There's not much left for them to do, and they decide they're going to shut the farm down. They may rent the land, or it may turn into recreational use. But you're right. We're going through some structural changes now.
Jim, thanks for the call. We'll go next to Cindy in Spring Green. Cindy, hi.
Hi. I'd like to just reiterate what everybody else has said. I know that you said they pay higher wages, the larger farms, but there's also the wear and tear that huge machinery has on our roads, and they don't pay a road tax to help defer those costs. And so I wonder what the trade-off is in high wages versus environmental versus the road wear and tear. Thank you.
Cindy, thanks for the call. Steve, with that road wear and tear, Roger earlier talked about environmental impact, worries about what I think you economist types call externalities, things that come as costs to the area that the producer doesn't directly pay for. How big a concern do you see that?
That is, with the bigger farms, that is becoming a problem. And the reason is because these bigger farms tend to go to larger equipment. The equipment is much heavier, and a lot of the roads are not built to handle that kind of weight. Not so much the roads, it's the bridges and the culverts. They tend to collapse. I mean, many of these culverts and whatnot were built, 50 years ago, and were not designed to handle those kind of heavy equipment. So you do end up with situations for farmers. It's not uncommon to hear a farmer say, look, I've got two fields that are adjacent to each other, but I got to go over a bridge or a culvert to get from one to the other, and I can't, which means I've got to go a mile around to get to the other field. Those are becoming more common because we're moving towards bigger and bigger equipment. So the ability to invest in kind of that basic infrastructure is going to become more important.
Thanks for that call. Talking to Steve Deller from UW-Madison, looking at the economics of farming, and it's changed a lot here in the state. Steve, a cultural issue. You mentioned this in your report. There's the idea associated going back to Thomas Jefferson and others of the independent farmer who their whole livelihood is the farm. It's big enough they can live off of it. It's not so big that they're an aristocrat of some sort. The farms you're talking about, the big, large-scale farms and these small hobby farms or farms where people need outside income, neither of them fit that sort of tradition, that cultural idea in the United States. Does this mean something?
Yeah, it is. And I think that that's a lot with what people are struggling with, is that those types of farms, the Jeffersonian notion of of that kind of farm, the economics just doesn't work anymore. And the economics has been turning against that kind of farm for over 70 years. And that's why we're seeing this kind of shift that if you want to maintain and continue to have some kind of farm enterprise and getting big is just not right for you, then we have to look at other sources of employment. And that's where this relationship gets flipped. And proximity, if you happen to have a smaller farm and you happen to be within a reasonable commuting distance to, say, in Eau Claire or La Crosse or even a Green Bay, where there are employment opportunities, you have a much better opportunity to keep the farm up and running than, say, if you don't have those employment opportunities. And it is, and I think that's partially what a lot of folks are really struggling with, is this idealized American farmer is changing.
We've been talking about the farms themselves. Have you seen similar consolidation trends when it comes to the suppliers of farm equipment, say seed, pesticides, and more on the one side, and the people who buy farmers' produce and turn it into the food we eat?
Yeah, there's been tremendous. I mean, in Wisconsin, when you look at the contribution of agriculture to the Wisconsin economy, it's the processing side. And there's been a lot of consolidation in that. But what we're seeing here is consumers are looking at their food options as kind of one of two kinds. One is kind of what we call commodity food products. This would be cheese that goes on a frozen pizza, right? It's just a pizza, and it's a frozen pizza. You're not willing to pay a whole lot for it, right? The other are artisanal foods, artisan foods, if you will, local foods, if you will, organic foods, foods that people are willing to pay a little bit more. And that's where we're seeing that break apart. If you're producing for that commodity market, you've got to kind of get big. I mean, that's the way the economics works. But with this growth in the interest of artisan cheeses, of artisan, well, artisan apples, I'm not sure you can, but locally grown, locally sourced, that's a market that has allowed a lot of the farmers to kind of say, hey, I can shift over into that market, and I can still keep the farm running. But I need to have something off-farm to keep the family afloat. There's one story of an organic farmer that said, you know, I love what I do. I love what I do, but I got three kids I got to put through college. And those are the kind of decisions that they're looking at. So it's kind of a consumer tastes have changed, and that's created opportunities for a lot of farmers.
And we'll leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Steve Deller, regional economist at UW-Madison, with us today to talk about new research on farm consolidation and its impact. He worked on it with Iris Sujin Park, now a graduate student in the Wisconsin School of Business at UW-Madison. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, it's this week's edition of Food Friday with some creative ideas for holiday baking, maybe something that'll put your last-minute project over the top. That more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, end partisan redistricting, switch to ranked choice voting, revitalize local media. Those are just a few of the ways our guest says Wisconsin's democracy can be saved. We'll find out what he says is at stake and how to fix it. First, road fatalities in the United States hit a 15-year high in the first half of 2021. The National Highway Traffic and Safety Administration has said in the past that 94% of traffic crashes are the result of human error. But our next guest says that number doesn't tell the whole story. Road design and the design of cars themselves also play a role in the lead up to a crash and can offer new ways to rethink traffic safety. We're exploring how we can make driving safer for everyone, drivers and cyclists and pedestrians. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have dangerous roadways in your community? What makes them dangerous? How would you make roads and highways safer? Or do you blame the drivers themselves in most cases? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@wpr.org. David Zipper is a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic called The Deadly Myth That Human Error Causes Most Car Crashes. David, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Yeah, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
In that piece, you mentioned this 94% number bounces around a lot. Can you tell us, first of all, where that comes from?
Well, it actually comes from our federal government, from NHTSA, which is the road safety agency that's part of the Department of Transportation. And 7 years ago, NHTSA put out a document that was very technical and had lots of caveats, but said that basically the final event that leads to a crash or the final contributing factor is all in 94% of the time is human error. And of course, there's lots of other stuff that happens before that final contributing factor, but 94% of the time in the end, somebody makes a mistake and that leads to the crash. And as soon as that paper came out, car companies and state departments of transportation and much of the traffic safety community just ran with it and simplified it down to simply 94% of crashes are due to people making mistakes on the road.
What does that leave behind, both in that actual report that said, hey, yeah, that's just the final cause, there's other stuff, and in the way it ends up being talked about in the media and elsewhere?
a lot, honestly. And I think maybe the best way to explain it is to give a quick example, if I could.
Sure.
So if you imagine, if you would, say a person driving an SUV in an urban area strikes a pedestrian, and the SUV driver was speeding and the pedestrian was not at a crosswalk. Now, the police could simply say, okay, well, that was due to human error. The pedestrian shouldn't have been crossing where there wasn't a crosswalk and the driver was speeding. Case closed. But honestly, but here's some other things. What if that SUV had pedestrian detection equipment? What if that had been an SUV at all? What if it had been a sedan, which is a lot less dangerous to pedestrians and to cyclists as well, by the way, who are dying with increasing frequency on our roads? What if the road had been designed differently so that it was narrower, which naturally leads a driver to slow down instead of driving, in this case, above the speed limit? And for that matter, what if the nearest crosswalk was half a mile away and the pedestrian didn't want to walk that far out of her way? Like, these are all contributing factors that are due to how cars are designed and how roads are designed and streets are designed that can lead to crashes that really are the responsibility, in my view, of car companies and our road engineers. They go beyond the responsibilities of the driver and the pedestrian, who may actually be the ones who are the people you actually see at the site of the crash when it's investigated.
With the focus on driver error, I think we've all seen in our lives many PSAs and other efforts to educate us as to how to be good drivers. And that's important, sure. But do you think that misleading stat that so much of this is caused purely by driver error is funneling our resources, our thoughts away from some of these more fundamental solutions you're talking about?
I do. It's not that drivers don't make mistakes or that we can't hurt or kill someone when we're behind the wheel. That certainly is a real issue. But if we focus all of our efforts on that, it really skews how we spend money and how we allocate resources as we're thinking about traffic safety. We could be doing a lot of things differently in terms of how we design roads, how we think about regulating cars at the federal level that we just omit as a society, and our government officials don't talk about because we're so focused on these education campaigns, which, by the way, Rob, have not been shown to be very effective when you have these millions of dollars spent across the country on publicity campaigns to encourage pedestrians and drivers to watch out. Like, my favorite example is one in Colorado, actually, where the Colorado Department of Transportation paid people to walk around in giant eyeball suits to tell pedestrians to look more carefully. There's no evidence that that does anything, but we still keep pouring taxpayer dollars into efforts like that.
Talking to David Zipper about roadway safety, he says we need to focus on a lot more than just driver error, even though that's often chalked up as a main cause of collisions. He says road design, car design are big pieces of the puzzle. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can follow David's work on Twitter at David Zipper. Let's get into some of the specifics you're talking about now, starting with road design in an urban setting. We know we've seen this is part of the story of increased road fatalities, larger cities, reckless driving, high speed driving. What kind of design solutions would you point local planners toward?
Sure. Well, here's a basic one. How about sidewalks and having complete sidewalk networks? Pedestrian fatalities are rising sharply in the U.S. while they're falling in East Asia and in the European Union. And I think a big part of the problem in the United States is that we underfund sidewalks. We often leave that to be the responsibility of local governments or to abutting property holders, which forces people who are vulnerable compared to those inside a two-ton automobile to be just walking on literally the side of the street or the road. I'd point to that. I would point to, and there's an effort called Complete Streets that I know cities like Milwaukee and Madison have embraced, where that you basically do things like road diets. You make the streets be a little bit narrower to encourage drivers to go a little bit slower. And you can add technologies called leading pedestrian indicators that let pedestrians walk out a little bit across an intersection a little bit before the light changes for drivers to give them a better chance of being visible. Those are just a couple of the street design efforts that I think can be very effective. Now, we talk about how cars are designed. That's really more of a federal issue, and that's something where we need Congress and the Department of Transportation to take a more active approach.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Kevin is with us in Madison. Kevin, hi.
Good afternoon. Just a couple of comments. My wife drives a Acura MDX, and it's got so many safety features, it makes it more dangerous to drive. So I'm not in favor of enhancing safety features in cars any farther than we've already gone. And the second one is, my second point is, we have a lot of road fatalities here in Madison, pedestrian fatalities and car accidents, car fatalities, because people speed excessively. We don't have enough police. That's the biggest problem in most communities. That's how you get people to obey the laws, is you enforce them.
Before you hang up, Kevin, I want to ask, what do you mean, what safety features in the car do you think make things less safe? I want to make sure we understand what you're saying.
Well, there's a braking for this, for example, this thing. I can't remember what it's called, but it's a braking feature. So if you pull up to a stop sign and I'm not unreasonably close to a car, it'll actually lock up the brakes on you. I've actually had a light turn green before and my brakes have locked up because the guy in front of me slows down and I almost get rear ended.
Gotcha. Kevin, thanks for the call and thanks for clarifying that. First of all, David, do you see, misguided safety features sometimes in cars?
Well, there's really no standards at the federal level about how high quality these automatic braking and features like that need to be. So you end up with some car models, and I don't know what model this caller has this at the moment. I can't recall that right now. Some are higher quality than others. So having more guidance from at the federal level would be certainly helpful. But I would also note that, to be honest, the safety features or a driver's decision to purchase safety features in his car or her car has an impact on more than himself, herself, and her family or his family. It's also going to have an impact on people outside the car. And that's actually a huge problem because most drivers, you heard the caller just now saying he didn't really like the features in his car. He wished he didn't have them, doesn't want more of them. Well, the problem is that safety features like, for example, pedestrian detection software and hardware actually protects people outside the car. So it's not actually just for his benefit that those features would be included. It's actually for the benefit of vulnerable road users. And that's where you really need regulations to step in to, in my view, make sure that those features are widespread, even if drivers themselves don't want it, because society writ large actually benefits.
And then to his second point, the solution for speeding, he says, is more speeding enforcement.
Well, I would offer, I would say maybe. I think that many people in minority communities would say that's going to impact them disproportionately. What actually might be there's a couple simpler options I might throw out there, Rob. One is simply installing speed governors on cars so that is there really a reason to be able to drive faster than say 80 miles an hour? I'm not sure there is. And yet automobiles sold in this country generally are all able to do so. So that's one way to fix things, at least on highways and interstates. Another is installing speed cameras, so that you know you're going to get a fine, or the likelihood is quite high, and it's going to be done pretty fairly by technology in potentially dangerous intersections. Now, drivers don't always like either of those solutions, but they have both been shown to have tremendous impacts on safety that are beneficial for society again.
Talking to David Zipper, visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School's Taubman Center for State and Local Government, with us today talking about how to make our roads and highways safer for drivers and their passengers, also cyclists and pedestrians. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have that road, that intersection in your community that seems unsafe just by design? Have you seen changes in your local community that you think are making things better or making things worse? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're continuing our conversation with David Zipper. He wrote a piece for The Atlantic about who and what's to blame for traffic crashes and fatalities. Says there's a lot of focus on the individual drivers, not enough focus on road design, systemic solutions that could prevent a lot of these problems. You could join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. This is an issue in the city of Milwaukee lately, trying to address an issue with reckless driving. New interim mayor Cavalier Johnson says it's his top priority. He outlined a plan in a press conference earlier this week.
My administration will engage in a comprehensive effort to increase the deployment of physical road improvements, strategies and technologies to hold drivers accountable, and public education to improve road safety and curb reckless driving in the city of Milwaukee.
I want to ask about the reckless driving part of this. There have been reports in Milwaukee and elsewhere about, David, increases in reckless driving. We've become worse drivers, apparently, during the pandemic. Do you see numbers bearing that out?
Yeah, there was a tremendous spike in this country in road fatalities when the pandemic began. We actually saw, and you mentioned at the top of our conversation, that 20,000 people died on American roads and streets and highways in the first 6 months of this year, the most in 15 years. That's after a 10% increase over the last 10 years and a spike the year before. So it seems that with fewer people driving due to the pandemic, there are more open roads and people are speeding more. And there's some anecdotal evidence that people are also driving more recklessly without, for example, wearing seatbelts as much, although we still have to see that. But one thing I think is really interesting, Rob, is this is actually really an American phenomenon. If you look at statistics of other countries around the world, New Zealand, Canada, Europe, everywhere else except the United States and Switzerland, weirdly, road fatalities dropped substantially over the last 18 months. But for some reason, the United States is going the wrong way. And to me, that's further evidence that we really need to really rethink how we approach road safety in this country and look for some new solutions.
Let's go back to our callers now. Anita is with us in Libertyville, Illinois. Anita, hi.
Really interesting and really well needed. But I just have a comment, and that is that it seems everywhere we go that the only thing the cops pull you over for is speeding. You know, we see a lot of other things. We see people not using the turn signal. We see people that are driving in a clearly marked turn only lane, and then they shoot ahead of the traffic that's been waiting in the legitimate straight ahead lane, and it causes road rage when the guy from the turn lane that cheated needs to pull in front of everybody else. I mean, it's stuff like this. People that are texting in the car, people that are using their handheld phone in the car. And I've had the police tell me in a most friendly way when I asked about that, that they cannot take a hold of the person's cell phone and ask to see it because the person owns that phone.
Anita, thanks for the call. David, do you see needs for improvement, either enforcement or other solutions for those non-speeding infractions that Anita's talking about?
Yeah, I think Anita's making some good points. Distraction is a huge problem, whether it's from cell phones or from our increasingly complicated onboard infotainment systems. There's going to need to be, I think, a reckoning around these technologies because we don't even fully know how dangerous they are. But all the data that we have seen thus far, the anecdotal evidence at least, suggests that it's a big contributor to the growth in crashes that we've seen in the U.S. over the last 15 years. It's been pretty steady. And one, if I could throw it out there, an interesting off on the horizon, but not that far away, solution from technology are known as driver monitoring systems, cameras and sensors that can keep an eye on the driver's attention and eyes on the road and can take action, giving a warning or even potentially halting the vehicle if you're not paying full attention. Tesla and certain high-end Cadillac cars already have technologies like this. And in the infrastructure bill that was just passed by Congress, there is a mandate that our Department of Transportation investigate solutions here. So expect to hear more about this as a driver monitoring system approach as a way to potentially address distraction in the years to come.
Thanks for the call, Anita. We'll go to Jeff next in Eau Claire. Jeff, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Jeff?
Yeah, well, I've been in law enforcement. I just retired 35 years with the State Patrol. And there's four categories that we routinely see and we focus on, and that's speed, have you been mentioning, operating under the influence, fatigue driving, and of course, everybody noted the distracted driving. The caveat to all this is that we really can't police our way out of it, as your guest attests to. There's got to be other things, and other countries are looking at, of course, higher, you know, moving these violations to different levels, from the civil aspect to criminal. Insurance companies need to get involved, but again, we can't police our way out of it. And the lady that called about turn lanes and all that, absolutely, but we just don't have enough officers to focus on all that. It really comes down to people, individual drivers, taking responsibility for their actions. That's why your insurance rates go up. That's why hospital costs go up, and the list goes on and on. And it's a great topic, and there's certainly a lot of layers and facets to this.
Jeff,
thank you.
Thanks for the call. Congrats on your retirement. David, one thing you said there, insurance companies maybe need to be more proactive if local and state governments aren't.
You know, they certainly could be helpful, I think, on the lobbying for some of these changes, in particular to road design. But I really appreciate Jeff's point. I think he's right that we can't police our way out of this crisis. And he's right again that we can look abroad for solutions. And, one thing I think is particularly interesting to listeners who might be wanting to learn more, there is a program that was actually born in Sweden called Vision Zero, born about 20, 25 years ago, that has as its premise the idea that human beings are going to make mistakes behind the wheel, but you shouldn't have to die for that. And that's why whenever there's a crash with Vision Zero starting in Sweden, investigators would go and look what led to the crash. Are there ways of creating more forgiving infrastructure, ways to mitigate the danger of a collision occurring and the severity of the injury or likelihood of death if something does occur? Now, Vision Zero spread over the last 25 years throughout Europe and to the US, but I think that we could do much, much more with that kind of a systemic approach. And Europe has a lot to teach us about this because, by the way, European death rates are on roads are less than half what we have in the USA right now. And Europe has a population one third larger. That should give us pause.
Yeah, reading your piece, it made me think of, I've talked to people who investigate air crashes, and they might say, yeah, pilot error was part of it. And that would never be the end of the conversation. It would be, how do we account for the risk of this pilot error and make sure people don't die as a result? Do we need to switch to more of that kind of mindset as we investigate road fatalities?
Well, Rob, that's a very astute observation that you just made. You're exactly right. We have the National Transportation Safety Board that looks at all possible contributing factors when there is an air collision, because it's so important to understand all the possible elements that went into it. But when a car crash leads to an injury or a death, we usually have a police report that assigns responsibility to one party, two, or none at all, and we just move on. And that is something that does need to change, in my view. And we're just starting, I think, in this country to think about what that could look like. And for those who are curious, I would point to New York City as a possible model, because earlier this year, New York City officially began shifting responsibility for traffic investigations away from the police toward the Department of Transportation, which, in officials' view, and my own as well, are better equipped to look at these sorts of infrastructure or vehicle design systemic problems, in addition to saying, okay, this person was driving drunk or this person was speeding unnecessarily. They're going a little bit deeper than that. And I'll be very interested to see what happens in New York. And perhaps it could hold lessons for other parts of the country as well.
David, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
David Zipper is a visiting fellow at the Harvard Kennedy School. He writes about transportation and urban innovation for outlets including The Atlantic, Washington Post, and Bloomberg's City Lab. He's with us today talking about the causes of traffic crashes and how to make roads safer. Still time for you to share your thoughts on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Coming up after the news, the head of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign says the state needs to become a laboratory of democracy again. He'll explain what that means and how he says we can make it happen. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.